So this week we conclude Chumash Shemos, Chumash HaGeula, with the Parsha of Pekudei. And Pekudei, which means countings, indeed begins with an accounting of all of the materials that were involved in the Mishkan, Eile Pekudei HaMishkan, and it goes through them, how much was used, and what it was used for. Indeed, according to the Medrash, this accounting was the initiative of Moshe, just to ensure that people should know exactly where their money was going to, that nothing had gone missing, everything had been used for a good cause. Some people like to have an accounting, a receipt for their endeavors. Although, as Rav Meir Shapira pointed out, when Bnei Yisrael offered all of their jewelry for the Egel, we never found that they demanded an accounting as to how all of that just resulted in one count. So some causes, I guess, people are more particular than others, either way. And perhaps Rav Meir Shapira was referring to his own Mishkan that was being set up, the Yeshivas Chachmei Lublin, either way. So the section that I'd like to focus on, and a comment that's very unusual, really caught my eye and I would say captured the imagination, relates to the silver that was used. And that is discussed in Pasuk Kaf Zayin and Pasuk Kaf Ches. And briefly, so that we don't get lost in the numbers, everyone gave a half a shekel, which means the amount of shekels that resulted, silver shekolim, will be roughly half the amount of people, because everyone gave a half. So there are 603,550 who contributed their shekolim, which means there will be 300,000 and then 1,775 shekolim. The two psukim, Kaf Zayin and Kaf Ches, outline what each of these sums were for. The 300,000, it's briefly to preview Baal Peh, the 300,000 shekolim were used as the sockets upon which the Mishkan rested. Each socket was the weight of what's called a kikar, and a kikar is 3,000 shekolim. So if there's 100 sockets, which they were all told, so 100 times 3,000, that's the 300,000. And that's Pasuk Kaf Zayin. As the Pasuk reads, Vayehi me'as kikar ha-kesef, me'as mem aleph taf, meaning the 100 of kikar kesef, those 100 kikars, latzekes es adonai ha-kodesh, they were to be used for the adonim, the sockets upon which the beams were placed, into which the beams were placed, and upon which they were based, ve'es adonai ha-paroches, and the sockets of the paroches, me'as adonim, 100 sockets, lim'as ha-kikar, for 100 kikar, kikar la'oden, one kikar equals one oden, and therefore that's all accounted for. That leaves us with the remaining 1,775 shekolim. What were they for? Pasuk Kavches. And what about those extra ones? Asav vavim la'amudim. They were used, that extra silver was used as hooks. Hooks for the pillars, upon which the various tapestries and drapings were hung. So this is really the breakdown, and everything is now accounted for. Almost all of the money, the 300,000 shekolim, is for the sockets at the base of the Mishkan, and then the extra 1775 shekolim is for the hooks. Vavim la'amudim. But there is a most intriguing comment of the Medrash, Medrash Rabbah. And that is, especially in light of the fact that it was Moshe who initiated the idea of having a reckoning, din v'cheshbon, that for what everything was used. But the Medrash states that Moshe momentarily forgot what it was that the extra silver money was used for. In other words, you have the 100 sokets, that's almost all of the money, that's 100 kikar, 300,000 shkalim, but the extra 1775, it momentarily eluded Moshe as to what exactly they were used for. In the words of the Medrash, Ad Sheheir HaKadosh Baruch Hu Es Einav, until Hashem illuminated his eyes, and he recalled, and he saw that they were in fact used for these hooks. Vavim La'amudim. That's a very interesting medrash. Many, many people speak about this medrash. He momentarily forgot what was the extra money used for, but they were used for the hooks, and then he was reminded. The matter is made more intriguing still when we consider a comment of the Sefer Megale Amukos. The Megale Amukos was from one of the great Gedolim of the 1600s, Rabbi Nosson Shapira. And he is quoted by the Chasam Sofer. And Megale Amuko says, as the Medrash says, that Hashem illuminated Moshe's eyes and he recalled that the silver, this extra silver was used for the for the hooks. How exactly did Hashem illuminate Moshe's eyes? Says the Megale Amukos, Hashem sent Rabbi Akiva to remind Moshe. So just in case the Medrash couldn't get any more enigmatic, it just did. Because it's Rabbi Akiva. What's Rabbi Akiva got to do with this whole situation? And why would Moshe momentarily lose sight of what it was used for? And Rabbi Akiva reminded him. But the Chasam Sofer says, Rabbi Akiva's relationship with these hooks is very deep-seated. And here is why. We find, interestingly, I mean, the extra money was used for what's called Vavim. Vav is a letter, but it also has a meaning. It means a hook. And moreover, its meaning as a letter is the same as a hook, because a hook connects things, and so does the letter Vav. So Vav, its function as a letter, is really, in its own way, like a hook. We find that Rabbi Akiva lays great emphasis on the significance of the letter Vav. How is this expressed? Rabbi Akiva is famous in the Gemara for expounding the letter Vav. What does it mean to expound the letter Vav? Very often, a section or a mitzvah or a part of a section in the Torah will begin with a Vav, like Ve'ish Asher such and such, or that type of thing. And. So what does it mean? It means and, to move on to the next thing. But Rabbi Akiva is famous for darshaning the Vavs. It doesn't say Ish Asher, it says V'Ish Asher. And Rabbi Akiva will learn an extra halacha from that Vav. Why does Rabbi Akiva darshan Vavs of all people? And this leads us, and I will say that this is one of those occasions where I mention this idea as much for the questions that it raises as for the explanations that are given. Because, as we know, the Jewish people are, the critical number is 600,000. And beyond that, I think we might even say, who's counting? And the reason why I say that is because when the Torah enumerates the Jewish people as they left Mitzrayim, it says, Kishesh Mi'ez Elef Ragli, approximately 600,000, which means as soon as it's 600,000, so then that's basically the number. It's very interesting that you have this kind of extra number. It's not exactly what they would call in modern Hebrew, agol. Absolutely rounded off. 600,000 would be seemingly the way to do it. But it isn't 600,000, not exactly. It's 600,000, and then there's always has to be someone who remembers that it's really 600,000 and 300 and 500, 3,000, 600, 3,550. That's not as round as 600,000. What is the meaning of this extra number beyond the basic 600,000? But the significance of these extra numbers, says the Chasam Sofer, is because it is possible for people to attach themselves to the core Jewish people, otherwise known as Geirim. As if to say, from the outset, even if you have your 600,000, But there's always a little bit more, however many there are with the significance of that, but there's always more. And why? Because it's always possible for there to be more people added to the Jewish people in the form of Gerim. And it's for this reason, says Chasam Sofer, that from the Shkalim, from the half Shkalim, which then became Shkalim, of these quote-unquote extra, beyond the 600,000, they made Vavim. And what is a Vavdu? It's a hook. It attaches. It connects. So these themselves were Vav people. And therefore, from their contribution, you had connectors in the Mishkan. Vavim la'amudim. And all of this, needless to say, just to wrap it up, is of great significance for Rabbi Akiva, because Rabbi Akiva was just such a person. Rabbi Akiva was Ben Gerim. He was descended from converts. So he himself had a Vav lineage or heritage. And that is why he, of all people, takes special notice of the letter Vav. And he will darshan the Vav, because the Vav, it just seems to be connecting, but the connection is of great significance for Rabbi Akiva. He'll darshan halachas from it. And to bring it back to where we started, this, says the Chasam Sofer, is the meaning behind that statement of the Megale Amukos of Rabbi Nosson Shapira, that when Moshe Rabbeinu temporarily forgot about what was done with the extra money, it was Rabbi Akiva who reminded him, because the type of people those extra shkolim refer to are really the type of people that Rabbi Akiva represents. So it's very interesting just to see how many, the different wavelengths, as we like to say, the Torah transmits on. The word Vav itself is a letter, it's a word, it reflects a certain type of person. That's why there are extra people. What is its role in the Mishkan? How does it play out in Halacha? And also in our understanding of the Psukim. So, having discussed a little bit, or made an opening comment with regards to Pikudei, if we move to the end of Perek Lamed Tes, and we will see that it details how the Mishkan was completed, basically. And let's have a look in Perek Lamed Tes, Pasuk Mem Beis and Pasuk Mem Gimel. And that's really the 5 weeks. And again, this year for us, over the period of 5 weeks, the five parshas, the pre-construction of the Mishkan and related matters has finally come to a conclusion. Perek Lamed Tes, Pasuk Mem Beis reads, Kechol asher tziva Hashem es Moshe, in accordance with everything that Hashem commanded Moshe, Kein asu b'nei Yisrael es kol avoda, so too did b'nei Yisrael do all of the avoda, all of the work. Pasuk Mem Gimel Vayar Moshe es kol hamelacha, Moshe saw all the work. Vihine asu asa, behold, they had done it. Kasher tziva Hashem kein asu, as Hashem commanded. Vayvarech osa Moshe, and Moshe blesses them. So what is noteworthy about these two psukim? Well, firstly, they seem to be one restating the other. And the pasuk says that the Bnei Yisrael did everything that was, you know, they were meant to do. And then Moshe saw that they had done everything that they were meant to do. What exactly is being added by the second pasuk, Pasuk Mem Gimel? But it's also true, if we note, that the way that these two psukim refer to the work that was done is not exactly the same. The term changes from one pasuk to the next. In Pasuk Mem Beis, it says once again, "Kechol asher tziva Hashem es Moshe, kein asu b'nei Yisrael es kol ha'avoda." Pasuk Mem Beis refers to the Jewish people doing all of the work, and it calls it avoda. In Pasuk Mem Gimel, it says, "Vayar Moshe es kol ha'melacha." Moshe saw the melacha, and behold, b'nei Yisrael had done as Hashem had commanded. So the question is, why is the first pasuk telling us that they did the avoda, and Moshe sees the melacha? And it's a very important question, because it brings us into what we could call the issue of synonyms, or seeming synonyms in Lashon HaKodesh. A real synonym are basically two words for the same thing. And there are many mefarshim, Vilna Gaon and others, who maintain and explain how there is never really two words in Lashon HaKodesh that mean the same thing. If they meant the same thing, it would be the same word. If there are two words, they might be similar to each other. They might be siblings to each other. But each one will have its character. Each one will have its specific connotation and message. And an example of that are the terms avoda and melacha. One of the adherents and exponents of this approach to quote-unquote synonyms is the Malbim, of course. For him, it is an anathema, the notion that two words mean the same thing. And he explains the difference between avoda and melacha. Because when you think about work, really, there's two ways that you can talk about it. The work that goes into something, that's work. And also the work that results. One of them is really a tally of investment, but the other is an expression of a result. And this is the difference between avoda and melacha. For avoda, it's what's invested in the matter. Fortuitously for us, although of course it doesn't mean as much in another language, but in English, lahavdil, we would use the term work in both capacities. A person can say that's 30 hours of work. So that the word work in that sentence refers to that which went into it. But if you talk about an object as a work, right, it's a classic work. So you're talking about the result. You're talking about the product. That's the difference between avoda and melacha. Avoda is what goes into it, and melacha is what comes out of it. And therefore, says the Malbim, the Pasuk Mem Gimel, speaks in praise of the Jewish people in terms of them coming forward and investing everything that was asked of them. That's called avoda. That's their input. As the Pasuk says, Kechol asher tziva Hashem es Moshe, kein asu b'nei Yisrael es kol ha'avoda. All the work that was needed to be done in order to produce the Mishkan was done by b'nei Yisrael. That is said in praise of the b'nei Yisrael. And incidentally, that the Pasuk says, from a certain point of view, only HaKadosh Baruch Hu can say that. Only Hashem can know that they gave of themselves everything that could be given. How could anyone else know? The next pasuk says that Moshe saw vayar Moshe es kol hamelacha. Moshe sees the results. He sees the product. And in fact, as the Malbim concludes, if there's any way that a person could know that the Jewish people had put everything into it, it's by seeing the result of what came out of it, because it came out exactly as Hashem had instructed. V'hinei asu osa kasher tziva Hashem kein asu. And Moshe gives them his blessing. So this is very interesting. It's a good illustration, an example of the idea. Words that they're largely, maybe we might use them interchangeably if we don't pay attention to the nuance and the color of each word. But then we lose out. Avoda and Malacha are not the same thing. Avoda is input and Malacha is output. Avoda is the effort and Malacha is the result. Interestingly, just while we're on the topic of avoda and melacha, and especially because it's something that we say regularly, there's a classic comment of Rabbeinu Bachya, and in fact Rabbeinu Bachya quotes this in the name of the Rambam. I'm not aware if there's another source where we have this from the Rambam, so these are gems. Every once in a while Rabbeinu Bachya, he'll bring us something that was said over or given over from the Rambam. And what does it relate to? Shabbos. We say in Kiddush on Shabbos morning, and it's from the Aseret HaDibros. Gwent Zochos Yom HaShabbos Lekadsho. Okay. Sheishes Yomim Ta'avod V'asisa Kol Melechtecha. So in describing the 6 days, both terms are used. Ta'avod, avoda, and performing melacha. That's interesting. Because the next time we see this term, it's when Shabbos comes. V'yom ha'shvi'i Shabbos l'Hashem Elokecha, lo sa'aseh kol melacha. Don't do any melacha. The question is, what about avoda? And it's very easy not to notice the asymmetry here, because for the 6 days of the working week, we had both terms present, ta'avod and do melacha. So then one would have expected, so then on Shabbos, lo tavod ve lo saseh kol melacha. But it doesn't say lo tavod, it just says lo saseh kol melacha. That's an interesting shaila. And Reina Bachya says as follows. It means, kol hasheshes yomim, for all 6 days, efshar lecha sheta'avod es Hashem yisbarach. The word ta'avod here, again, the way we would use it, a person's avoda, al ha-torah v'al ha-avoda. So the avoda here in question is avoda Hashem, living as a Jew, im asiyas kol melachtecha, together with pursuing a livelihood. So in other words, what we're being told is, for 6 days of the week, you pursue both. Ta'avod, right, avoda, meaning Jewish living, mitzvahs, and so on, together with va'asisa kol melachtecha. Aval yom hashvi, but when it comes to Shabbos, kulo yeh l'shem elokecha. So that's Shabbos hayom l'shem. Which means, of the two things that one does during the week, one continues with one and rests from the other. Lo saseh kol melacha, klal, no melacha, but there's still avoda. Because avoda is religious pursuits, Torah pursuits. It's a fascinating way of looking at this pasuk that we're so familiar with. Ze shamati b'shem haRambam zal. This I heard in the name of the Rambam, says Rabbi Nebuchadnezzar. So once again, and I wonder though, because in modern Hebrew, also lahavdil, if a person says that I'm going to work, so he says ani yotze lavoda. He doesn't say ani yotze limlacha. So that it could be that this nuance is lost on us a little bit, because we use the term avoda also for a person's parnasa. Having said that, we also find a psukim which we'll call avoda a person's parnasa. In fact, the Shir Shayom for today, Rosh Chodesh, Barchi Nafshi, Yetze Adam Lefa'alo Vela Avodaso Ade Arev. I mean that refers to his earning a living as avoda as well. So it's something that one always needs to keep an eye on. But again, as soon as our eyes are opened, words that are used together in conjunction with each other, but each one has its own hue, each one has its own coloration and connotation. Avoda and Malacha. Finally, how does Pasuk Mem Gimel end? Okay, the Torah says they did the avoda. Moshe said they had done the malacha. The product came out perfect. Vayivorech osam Moshe, and Moshe blessed them. And the question that everyone wants to know is, what did he say? I mean, if we may ask, what was the bracha? It happens to be Rashi talks about it. He cites it from the Medrash. Vayivorech osam Moshe, what was the bracha? Amar lehem, he said to them, Yehi ratzon shetishre shchina b'masi adeichem, may the shchina rest on the work of your hands. And then he said, V'yinoam Hashem alokeinu aleinu u'masi adeinu kolinu aleinu. Now that's familiar to us as a pasuk in Tehillim. So that's interesting. Moshe is already quoting a pasuk in Tehillim. Is that an unusual situation? Not at all. Moshe was one of the co-authors of Tehillim. Tehillim was co-authored by 10 people. David HaMelech put it all together. B'nai Korach are some of them. And Moshe. Tfila LaMoshe Isha Elokim. That begins a series of 11 chapters, which were all authored by Moshe. We say them regularly, but these are Moshe Rabbeinu originals. And the first one is Tfila LaMoshe, which ends with the pasuk, V'noam Hashem Elokeinu Aleinu. So Moshe isn't quoting David HaMelech. David HaMelech is redacting Moshe when the time comes in Tehillim. And that, as Rashi says, V'hu echad mi'achad esrei mizmorim shebetfila leMoshe. This is one of the 11 prokim of Tehillim contributed by Moshe. So, in brief, what Rashi has brought us from the Medrash, and it's interesting that Rashi saw it as necessary or pertinent to tell us what the bracha was. I mean, Rashi's job, we always remind ourselves, his goal is to resolve Pshuta Shamikra. Pshuta Shamikra says, Moshe blessed them. We might be curious to know what the bracha was, but is that a pshat question that needs to be addressed? That itself is an interesting shaila, why Rashi felt it relevant to let us know, to appraise us of the content of the bracha. But he did. And what does this mean? So one of the great Balei HaMusar of recent times, Reb Chaim Friedlander, Zatzal, he was the Mashgiach in Ponovich, and he has his Sfarim are called Sifsei Chaim, very, very wonderful Sfarim. And he has an insight into this Rashi, which I think is most profound. Again, the Bnei Yisrael have just completed the Mishkan. And Moshe gives them a bracha, may the divine presence rest on the work of your hands. Asks Reb Friedlander, which work of your hands? What is Moshe referring to when he says, may the divine presence rest there? We might be inclined to say that Moshe is referring to the Mishkan. You just made a Mishkan, that is your handiwork, ma'aseh yideichem, may the Shekhinah rest there. But Reb Friedlander says, no, that is a limited message. That is a limited blessing. Because the truth is that the presence of the Mishkan in the middle of the camp of Israel should change everything they do. You cannot compare. It is not the same. The Jewish people with the Mishkan at the center and the Jewish people not with the Mishkan, it's not the same. And therefore, the greatest blessing that Moshe gives to the Jewish people is that having now made the Mishkan, and with all of you encamped around the Mishkan, may the Shekhinah dwell in everything you do. Not only in the Mishkan. Right? It should emanate out and change and affect and elevate and illuminate all the things you do. Yihi ratzon shetishri Shekhinah b'maaseh yadeichem. The Mishkan in the middle of the camp changes the entire camp. And all the or should do, and all the things that happen there, and the Shekhinah should rest in all of them. What's very beautiful is Rav Chaim Friedlander proceeds to apply this idea to our own experience, to our ongoing experience. How so? Because we also say the pasuk of Vihi Noam, Moshe's blessing. Every week, at least once. But significantly, this is what we say as we cross the threshold, really, on Ma'ariv, on Motzei Shabbos, back into the week. And what's a critical transitional point? Vi Noam. Which is Vi Noam Hashem Elokeinu. That's how it all begins. And what are we saying? Says our Friedlander, why would we choose Moshe's blessing for the Mishkan and apply it on Motzei Shabbos? Because the message is exactly the same. Shabbos, one could say, is to the week what the Mishkan is for the camp. In that it's present, but the question is its contribution limited to Shabbos itself? It shouldn't be. In the same way that when the Mishkan was made, Moshe said, now that there's a Mishkan here, it should change the entire camp. So the Jewish week is a camp, and in the midst of that camp is called Shabbos. And the blessing is, V'noam Hashem Elokeinu Aleinu, Shabbos should illuminate the entire week, just like the Mishkan illuminated the entire camp. The elevation of Shabbos shouldn't be left behind in Shabbos. That elevation should translate into illumination and cast its light on the week ahead. And therefore the very same blessing that Moshe gave, may the divine presence rest on the work of your hands. When? For the next 6 days. Not just on what you did in Shabbos, but it should be a Shabbos elevated week. And all the 6 days should be different. There is a classic comment of the Shemi Shmuel, the Sokotchover Rebbe, where the Gemara says that this is Masechet Shabbos and Kuf Yud Ches. Kol ha-ma'anik es ha-Shabbos. If a person delights in Shabbos, nos nimlo mishalos libo. They give him all of his heart's desires. Which sounds very nice. Except, says the Shemi Shmuel, we need to ponder and investigate. Is that necessarily always the case? Whoever delights in Shabbos, whatever they want, they'll get. And moreover, is it always even advisable that that's the case? I mean, it depends what the person wants. Maybe they don't really want such a good thing. They're going to get it just because they want it. But that's why the Shem Yishmuel says that if you look carefully at the Gemara doesn't say that a person who delights in Shabbos, they fulfill his heart's desires. There is an expression for that. We said it 2 days ago, 3 days ago. Mevarach HaMachodesh, Chaim Sheyimalu Mishalos Libenu Letova. When you talk about fulfilling a person's desires, that's called Lemalos. The Gemara never said if a person delights in Shabbos, Mimalim Lo Kol Mishalos Libo. They fulfill his heart's. It didn't say that. It said Nosnim Lo Kol Mishalos Libo. They give him his heart's desire. But what does that mean? It means that sometimes a person doesn't really know what their heart should be desiring. Sometimes, through the grind of the day-to-day, of the sheishes yemei ha-maaseh, what a person wants for themselves can become woefully diminished to very, very temporal and uninspiring goals. Maybe they just want a raise or a promotion or Plony's office without them in it. And such goals. And by the time they come to Shabbos, so what does their heart want? Very limited things. What is the greatest thing that Shabbos gives to a person? What to want, what to desire. And a person goes through Shabbos and connect with it. By the time they finish, what have they received for that week? A new wish list. Worthy goals. Elevated ideas, things to wish for. No stimlo, kol mishalos libo. And that, as Rav Friedlander said, that's something that should accompany them over the course of the week ahead. It's very interesting. The Gemara famously discusses a person who's away from civilization. He doesn't know what day it is. And so now the question is, well, so now what does he do? He doesn't know what day Shabbos is. He's completely lost track of time. So he can't be without Shabbos, but he doesn't know what day Shabbos is. He can't assume each day is Shabbos, otherwise he'll never get out of there. But he has to have some type of Shabbos. So the question is, so how should he configure his personal Shabbos until he then reconnects with the actual Shabbos? And in the Gemara, there are two opinions. Amazing. It's a machlokus. Here you have this individual. He is completely lost, nowhere near civilization. The only thing to keep him company is a machlokus in the Gemara as to what he should do. Well, what are the two opinions? The first opinion says, count 6 days and then keep the seventh day as Shabbos. The second opinion says, keep the first day. From the time that you've lost track, keep the first day as Shabbos and then keep walking for 6 days. So what type of machlokus is this? I mean, what is behind this? Do you keep day one as Shabbos and then walk for 6 days? Or you walk for 6 days and keep day seven as Shabbos? Says the Shem Yishmuel, again, of Sokachov, when you have a machlokus like this, again, you have to paskin, you have to decide. But there's room to see both sides. What the Gemara is saying is that Shabbos has a dual relationship with the rest of the week. On the one hand, it is day seven from the week that just went by. But on the other hand, it is day one for the week that follows. And that's why some say, keep the first day, or keep the seventh day. That's the Gemara's way of saying Shabbos is both day seven and day one. So these are, we have Shabbos every week. The more we go into it, and the more we derive from it, so certainly the more we will leave with, armed for the week ahead. So these are based on Rav Friedlander's classic comments on the Rashi regarding the bracha that Moshe gave for the Mishkan, the sanctuary for Bnei Yisrael. Shabbos is the sanctuary of the week, and the bracha is translated from space to time with the message, hopefully, intact. So from here, we move towards the end of the Parsha, and we have the final installment of all of the component parts of the Mishkan. That's in Perek Mem. And I'd like to take a look at one Pasuk specifically, and that is Pasuk Kaf. Okay, Perek Mem, Pasuk Kaf. And it describes Moshe as he is bringing everything in and arranging everything as it should be. Vayikach, Pasuk Kaf of Perek Mem. Vayikach Moshe took, Vayitain es ha'edus el ha'aron. He placed the edus in the aron. The edus is the luchos, and he put them in the aron, in the ark. Vayosem es ha'badim al ha'aron, and he places the badim, also attaches them to the ark. Vayitain es ha'kapores al ha'aron milamala. And he places the covering of the aron also from on top. Effectively assembling the Aron. Interestingly, to begin with Al Rishon, the very first thing the Pasuk says that he did is that he put the Eidus, he put the Luchos in the Aron. Which raises the question. I mean, where were the Luchos until now? We assume that as soon as the Aron was made, and the Aron has already been ready for a number of weeks. I mean, this is the first of Nisan when Moshe is putting everything together. He just now inserts the Luchos into the Aron. Where have they been until now? Where can they be until now? Says Ramban, this is explained in light of the Pasuk in Parshas Ekev, which tells us that as soon as, or actually accompanying, the instruction for Moshe to carve a second set of luchos, which he would then go up and Hashem would write on them, Hashem gave him two instructions. Number one, carve luchos, and number two, ve'osisa lecha aron eitz, and make a wooden ark for the luchos. This is long before the Mishkan is constructed. And as Moshe says, so he prepared both of those things, he received the second set of luchos, and he placed them straight away into the Aron. Which Aron? The Aron that he made. Now that Aron was not the same one that Bezalel made, which means that there were actually two. When the time came, did there remain two side by side, or is there any capacity for the original one? That's an interesting shaila. But pending the making of Bezalel's Aron, if you want to know where the luchos are, they're in Moshe's Aron. And what happens at this critical moment is it's finally time for the transfer of the luchos, which have been in Moshe's Aron that he made all those weeks or months ago. And it is months ago. It's from the day after Yom Kippur. This is the beginning of Nisan. It's almost half a year. They've been in Moshe's Aron. And now they're finally transferred to Bezalel's Aron. And that teaches us that even Bezalel's Aron is predominantly or primarily to house the luchos. The luchos need an aron. Even before there is a Mishkan, the luchos need an aron. Moshe had to make one. Which means even after the Mishkan is there, the aron is there primarily to house the luchos. That makes the aron different than every other vessel that resided in the Mishkan. Because every other vessel that resides in the Mishkan is there to serve the Mishkan. It's avodah. The menorah, the mizbeach, the Shulchan, there are avodas that are done. Those, they are kelim of the Mishkan. They exist for the Mishkan, which surrounds them. The Aron exists for the luchos that reside inside of it. And that makes it, if one may say, as Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, Zatzal, puts it, the Aron, or to paraphrase it into English, but the Aron is not a kli of the Mikdash. It's a kli in the Mikdash. But it exists primarily for the luchos. That's why it pre-existed. The Aron pre-existed the Mishkan. And it's interesting, just before moving on to later parts of the Pasuk, to note, Chazal seem to have emphasized this as well. How so? It's a turn of phrase, but it's so revealing. We spoke last week about the whole discussion with Moshe and Bezalel. What should be made first? The body of the Mishkan, the building of the Mishkan, or the vessels inside? And that was their whole exchange. Moshe said one way, Bezalel said another way, so on and so forth. That's the way we normally describe it. What should be made first? The body of the Mishkan or the vessels? Actually, the Gemara, this is in Brachos and Daf Nun Hey, the way the Gemara describes it is a little different. There's a nuance here. Says the Gemara, Moshe was told by Hashem, go and tell Bezalel to make the Aron, the Kelim, and the Mishkan. That's three things. the Aron, pardon me, the Mishkan, and then the Aron and the Kelim. That's three things. Moshe then flips it round and tells Bezalel that Hashem said to make the Aron, the Kelim, and the Mishkan. And it keeps on going. It keeps on going that way. So we always focus on what's first, the building or the vessels. But to note that even when referring to the vessels, the Aron is mentioned separately. It's not just an issue of Mishkan and Kelim. It's Mishkan, Aron, and Kelim. Because the Aron is not one of the Kelim, not in the full sense of the word that exists for the Luchos. And this, the transition from Moshe's Aron to Bezalel's Aron took place on the 1st of Nisan, here, when the Mishkan was set up. Moving on in the Pasuk. It says, Vayosem es habadim al ha'aron. Vayosem es habadim al ha'aron. So then he attaches the badim, the poles, to the Aron. And here, there's room for a simple question. Because here, unlike the Eidos, which were prior to this, were within Moshe's Aron, and now the time has come to move them, the poles have already been attached to the Aron. Parshas Vayakel, which describes the building of the Mishkan and all of the Kelim, states explicitly that Bezalel made the Aron, and he inserted the poles into the rings that were the side of the Aron. So that is something that's attaching the poles to the Aron has already been done. That makes it more difficult now. What exactly does the pasuk mean when it says that Moshe was the one who attached the poles? And the Meshech Chochma has a chiddush here, which on the one hand, it is it's a major chiddush. It's actually also the simplest reading of the Pasuk. And sometimes those two things go together, depending on who's behind it. Says Meshech Chochma, Bezalel had indeed already inserted the poles into the rings. Where were those rings? At the side of the Aron, towards the top. Okay. Then the Aron was brought into the Mishkan, into the Kodesh HaKodashim, and the Pasuk says, to read every word, Vayosem es habadim al ha'aron. Moshe placed the poles on the Aron. We translated a bit more loosely that he attached them to the Aron. He placed them on the Aron in the sense of attaching them. But the Meshech Chochma says, Pshuto shel Mikra, is that he actually placed the poles on the Aron. That means on top of the Aron. When the Aron was traveling, the poles would be in the rings at the side of the Aron. When the Aron was resting in the Kodesh HaKadoshim, the poles would be on top of the Aron. Al ha'aron. Now, this is seemingly more simply said than easier said than done, in the sense that what exactly is the Meshech Chochma suggesting? That they removed the poles from the rings, which were at the side of the Aron, and then placed them on top of the Aron, like that is to say, like on the outer rim of the Aron on each side? Seemingly, but it's very difficult. Because the Pasuk says, and the Meshech Chochma himself quotes this, the Pasuk says, V'lo lo yosuru mimenu. It is forbidden to remove the poles from the rings. So if it's forbidden to remove them, how can you go from placing them on the side of the Aron to the top? Unfortunately, the Meshech Chochma did not elaborate on this point, leaving us to conjecture that either somehow it was permissible because they are still on the Aron, they're not being removed and detached from the Aron, but rather they're just taken from the rings to be on the Aron itself. Maybe that's not an infraction. Or could it possibly be that the makeup of the rings, which were near the top, allowed room to actually have the poles on the outer rim, the outer edge of the lid of the Aron, even while still being in the rings? I'm not sure which of those is the least mechudash suggestion. But either way, this is Meshachachma, and he says it's Pshuta Shemikra. The Pasuk doesn't say that he brought, that he put the poles into the rings. He says it placed the poles on the Aron. That's exactly what he did. Bitzalah hadn't done that. Bitzalah placed them into the rings to be carried once they rested in the Kodesh HaKadoshim. So then Moshe placed those poles, took them from being on the side to being on top. And moreover, says Meshech Chochma, because we, I think, are reeling that the Meshech Chochma is just getting going. This will also explain to us a pasuk later on in the Torah and answer a question that's raised by Tosfos. In Parshas Bamidbar, the Torah describes how the Mishkan would be dismantled and transported in Parshas Bamidbar. In Perek Dalet, pasuk Hey and Vav, it talks about how they would take the parochas down and cover the aron with it, which means the parochas continues to serve the aron even in transit, because it literally wraps the aron. And then in Bamidbar Perek Dalet Pasuk Vav, V'nasnu alav, they should place other coverings, kisui or tachash, from the tachash skins, beget klil techeles, and also a garment of techeles. V'somu badav, and they shall place its poles. Comes the time to travel, v'somu badav, time to place the poles. Ask the Tosfos in Maseches Yuma and Dafayin Beis, at last we heard, the poles are already there, because you can't remove them. The pasuk says, "Betaba osa aron yu abadim." They've got to be in the rings. Lo yasur mimenu. They can't be removed. So if they can't be, if they're always there, why do they need to be placed when they're about to travel? They're already there. That's Tosus's question. Tosus present a fascinating answer to this question from one of the Balei Tosus, Rabbeinu Yaakov of Orleans. And Rabbeinu Yaakov says it's a big chiddush that when the pasuk says as they're about to travel, v'sam badav, and they place the poles, it doesn't refer to placing the poles in the rings of the aron. They're there the whole time. It refers to placing the poles on the shoulders of the Leviim who will carry the aron. Place pole on top of Leviim. That's v'sam badav. That's quite a chiddush. Says Meshech Chochma, if you were to ask me, it seems the pasuk is again kipshuto. Because as long as the aron has been at rest, the poles have not been at the side, ready to carry. They've been resting on top of the aron, as our pasuk says. So when the time comes to travel, v'samu badav, they will need to position the poles in the side, however you get from A to B, in order to travel. Once again, kipshuto. So this is the suggestion of the Meshech Chochma. Again, it's a big chiddush. If I find someone who can explain to me fully what the Meshech Chochma means to say somehow, I'd be very grateful. And I guess that one needs to just continue looking. But those are the words of the Meshech Chochma, and even the basic idea itself is an unbelievable chiddush. And again, it's a chiddush, and it's the simple meaning of the words. V'samu abadim al ha'aron, they were placed on the aron, as simple as that. Someone else, who is also really reacting to the same question as the Meshech Chochma, why would Moshe be placing the poles if they're already there, if Bezalel already put them there, is the Netziv. And there's often an affinity between the Meshech Chochma and the Netziv, and that Beis HaMedrash in terms of the type of issues that they will be responding to and questions that they will be dealing with. And the Netziv has his own now interpretation as to what happens. Says the Netziv, the poles were in the rings. Once they've been put in there, and they have to stay there. But still there was room for Moshe to do something when they rested in the Kodesh HaKodashim. Why? They're already there. The Gemara states that the two poles, actually, when they're in position and the paroches is now suspended in front of them. They were actually brought forward so that they protruded and pushed back the paroches into the Mishkan. Says the Netziv, that is a positioning of the poles, which is only applicable when they're resting and the paroches is they're in the Kodesh HaKadoshim and the paroches is suspended. When you move the Aron, the poles will be centered. They will be equal, equal part of the pole on one side of the ring as the other. But it's only when it comes to rest, they're actually protruded, they are brought west, eastwards to protrude into the past, to push the paroches back into the Heichal. The Netziv himself elsewhere explains what was the significance of them pushing the paroches into the Heichal. Because the Medrash says that Aaron was not allowed to enter the Kodesh HaKadoshim except once a year, although there's much discussion about that. Aaron cannot just enter anytime he wants to the Kodesh HaKadoshim. And the Medrash says, Aaron can't, but Moshe can. Moshe can enter the Kodesh HaKadoshim. But the question is, for what? Why would Moshe enter the Kodesh HaKadoshim? He's not a Kohen. He's not a Kohen Gadol. He's not a Kohen at all. He's not doing Avodah there. But we know that Moshe communed with Hashem by the Kruvim. Hashem says, "My eye will speak to you from between the two Kruvim." So Moshe goes into the Kodesh HaKadoshim in order to receive Torah. That's where it happens. Anyone else who would ever go in there is going there for the Avodah on Yom Kippur. But Moshe is going there on a regular basis to receive the Torah. However, says the Netziv, he is quite adamant and firmly of the opinion that no one can actually go into the 10 Amos that are the Kodesh HaKadoshim. Which means, even Moshe, that means that if Moshe is going to have direct contact, uninterrupted, with the Kruvim, there has to be a space available for him, which is still actually part of the Mishkan and not the Kodesh HaKadoshim. How would that space become available? By the poles of the Aron pushing the paroches out, one Amma, into the Mishkan. That's where Moshe stood. So he's behind the curtain, but he's not in the Kodesh HaKadoshim. And that was the purpose of those poles there, being positioned the way they were. And therefore, says the Netziv, if you look, when the Pasuk says, again, the Pasuk we've been focusing on, Perek Mem, Pasuk Kaf, Vayosem es habadim al ha'aron, he attached the badim, he placed them, and he placed them by the aron. What is there to place? Betzalel's already put them there. Yes, Betzalel's put them there centered. Moshe then placed them the way they need to be, positioned them the way they need to be, when the aron is at rest, with the poles jutting out, and pushing the paroches eastwards for one amma. What is also very interesting, and we spoke of synonyms before, avoda and malacha. If you look at the three things that are described in Pasuk Kaf, after Vayikach, whatever Vayikach means, we didn't even talk about the first word in the Pasuk, but Vayitenes ha'edus el ha'aron. So Moshe puts the luchos into the aron. Vayosem es habadim al ha'aron. And then he puts the badim onto, or whatever that means, on the aron. Vayitenes ha'kaperes al ha'aron, milamal, and then puts the kaperes. Three things are happening. Inserting the luchos, positioning the poles, and placing the kaperes. But the verb shifts. For placing the luchos, it says, vayiten es ha'edus. For the poles, it says, vayosem. And for the lid, for the kaperes, for the covering, it says once again, vayiten. What is behind the shift of vayiten and vayosem? And why does it go back and forth? But here we see that, as many Mefarshim point out, Itrik Sava Kabbalah and others, vayiten is if there's less specification as to how it's done or less effort involved in being precise. So that's called vayiten. Lasim, to place, is much more precise. What's the classic example of this? When Avram sends out Hagar. So what does he give them? Vayiten la lechem umayim. Lechem v'chemas mayim. He gave her bread and a flask of water, some al shikhma, placed it on her shoulder. So the Torah Tamima says, you see, when it says generally about him giving it to her, it says vayiten. But when it talks specifically about where he placed it, so that's vayosem. Vayiten el hagar, some al shikhma. So too here, says the Ksava Kabbalah, the luchos were placed in the aron, but there's no specification as to where exactly in the aron they need to be placed. They just need to be inside. That's called vayiten. The kapores, the third phrase, it's very easy to place it exactly because it's an exact fit. But the one that needed most precision was the badim. And I think this works out whether it's like the Meshech Chochmah or whether it's like the Netziv. It's very precise. You're placing them on the outer rim just so, right? They're round. They need to be placed very carefully. They shouldn't roll off. They need to be positioned exactly one amah to be brought out, and so on and so forth. That's called sima. And that's why it says vayosem es habadim al ha'aron, as opposed to the other two vayitens. So the closer we look into these psukim, the more attention we pay to every aspect of it, the more we see how, although by this stage, and this is already the sixth or seventh time that all of these things are being discussed, and we're settling down for expecting a repetition to see just how much is yet revealed in this final chapter, these final psukim of Pikudei. And having spoken about the end of Pikudei, we go back to the beginning, just for the final one or two moments. Eile Pikudei HaMishkan Mishkan HaEdus. This is the reckoning of the Mishkan, Mishkan HaEdus. And Rashi notes that the word Mishkan relates to the word Mashkon, which is a pledge or collateral. Shnei Pa'amim, HaMishkan Mishkan, Shnei Pa'amim. It says twice, Remez LeMikdash, it's a Remez to the Beis HaMikdash, Shenis Mashkein B'Shnei Churbanin, Allah V'Nusayim Shal Yisrael. The Mishkan was taken as collateral twice for the sins of Bnei Yisrael. First Beis HaMikdash, second Beis HaMikdash. So the word Mishkan, we normally relate it to the word Shechina, which of course it is, but in this instance also has a connotation of Mashkon. And what is the full significance of calling the Beis HaMikdash a Mashkon? So I heard a very beautiful interpretation, much, much to ponder. There is a halacha. I mean, what do we need to do to get the Beis HaMikdash back? I think the strict answer is, well, if it was taken because of your debt, let's call it a debt, Bavanu Sem Shal Yisrael, pay off your debt, and then you'll get it back. Well, that's the full answer. That's the ideal answer. But there's a halacha with regards to Mashkon, which we know from Parshas Mishpatim. If you take collateral, someone owes you a debt, you take collateral against that debt, but if they need it, you have to give it back to them. It makes it harder to collect the debt, so be it. But you need to come towards them. If they need it, if it's daytime clothing, return it to them for the day. If it's nighttime clothing, return to them for the night. So there's an amazing idea in the Beis HaMikdash being referred to as the Mishkan, because it means that even if the Jewish people are not able to fully pay off their debt, ideally they should. Ideally they should do full tshuva and so on and so forth. But it's possible to get the Beis HaMikdash back by different means. If the Jewish people collectively say, this was taken as collateral, but we need it. We can't do without it. And so you have to give it back. Hashem follows the laws of the Torah. It's Dinei Mashkon. But that calls to us to maybe think a little differently, because it's difficult, admittedly. We don't have experience of the Beis HaMikdash. We don't have the contrast of what it was like. For those that experienced all those centuries ago the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, the contrast was immense. But for us, without it, so then to feel that we can't do without it, it's difficult. It's a mashkon. Sometimes the difficulties of the Golus make it a little easier for us to realize that a successful Golus is not a successful Jewish people. A successful Jewish people is Geula. And sometimes the Golus knocks a little bit louder than we'd like it to. And this, of all the ways that the Jewish people respond to their tzaras, each of them more admirable, really, than the others. But part of that is perhaps to rethink a little bit. This isn't how the national experience of the Jewish people should be. Forget about things like a light to the nations, which is which they would rebuff and reject anyway in the current state. But just to dwell in peace, to be let alone and certainly appreciated in the way that we hope for, that doesn't happen in the godless. And as difficult as it is for us to recognize and be reminded of that, but perhaps if we make room for the thought that the Beis HaMikdash is a mashkon, and to be thinking more towards Geula as the final, as the optimum solution for us, and not just making Golus work, that itself can be a trigger for the Geula to be brought about, and that's something that we hope which will happen. B'mehera b'yameinu, chazak chazak v'nischazek, and we should hear b'saras tovus b'karov. Just to mention that next week, Mitzvah Hashem, we'll be discussing matters of Purim. That will be our last week, our last year before Purim.